becomes the author of the work, insofar as the copyright law is concerned. And when I say the author, I really mean the author. It's as if the person you hired doesn't even exist in the eyes of the copyright law. And indeed, their name doesn't even have to be on the copyright registration form. I suspect, but I really don't know and would hate to disillusion myself by researching it, that the work-for-hire concept was developed to cover such things as fabric companies that print copyrighted designs on their cloth. They wanted to be sure that the company, not the backroom dork who actually designed the pattern, was the owner of the copyright. Seems reasonable enough. But for showbiz, works for hire in the entertainment industry. Here's an example of works for hire in the entertainment world. Suppose you are Walt Disney Pictures, and you hire someone to write the theme for Snow White. I picked the example of a motion picture for a particular reason, as you'll see later in this chapter. In this situation, Walt Disney Pictures, the corporation, becomes the author of the work, and the person hired to write it disappears. Does this mean the writer won't get his or her name listed as the writer of the song, in the film, on the charts, etc.? Usually not. The real creator customarily gets credit. But sometimes, for example, with jingles written for radio or television commercials, a creator doesn't. Also, the amount of money that the real creator gets is usually affected by this type of arrangement. Most of the time, they're paid exactly the same money, whether or not the work is for hire. However, a number of important rights are drastically different in works for hire, as you'll see later in this chapter. So whenever you're creating a work for hire, be alert to the consequences. They're not good for you. Technical definition. Under the copyright law, a work for hire can be created in only one of two ways. They're set out in Section 101 of the Copyright Act and are a bit technical. You can skip to the duration of copyright section a little further on in this chapter if technical things make you squirmy, but try it first. The two ways to get a work for hire are: 1. The work is made by an employee within the scope of employment. An example of this is the fabric designer I mentioned before. The test of whether there is employment is not the one used for the income tax laws, or in fact, for any other type of laws. The law says that the employer must actually be directing or supervising the creation of the work in a very specific way. The major case in this area is Community for Creative Nonviolence v. Reed, Volume 490, United States Reports, page 730, 1989, in which the Supreme Court held that a Vietnam memorial sculpture was not a work for hire because the people who paid to have it created didn't exercise control over the details of the work, didn't supply the tools, had no ongoing employment relationship, etc. Normally, although not always, a songwriter is given a lot of latitude in his or her creation, so it would fail the employment test. I suppose if a songwriter is given very specific instructions and is supervised during the process, he or she might be considered an employee under the copyright laws, but that's very rare. The most common works for hire in the music area are those that fall under this next provision. 2. If a copyright is not created by an employee within the scope of employment, it can only be a work for hire if it meets all of the following criteria. The work must be 1. Commissioned, meaning created at the request of someone, not a previously created work. 2. Created under a written agreement that specifies it's a work for hire. And 3. Created for use in one of the following: A. A motion picture or other audiovisual work. This is the most common area where songs are treated as works for hire. It includes musical scores, a title song written for a film, etc. Remember, these songs do not have to be written by employees. They just need to be under a written agreement that says, 1. They're works for hire, and 2. they're commissioned for use in an audiovisual work, meaning created for that work, not a pre-existing song that's added to the work. B. A collective work. A collective work is a collection of individual works, each of which is independently capable of copyright. Examples are an anthology of short stories, a magazine with a number of copyrightable articles, an encyclopedia, etc. C. A compilation. A compilation is a work made by compiling a bunch of things, and thus it includes collective works, where the parts are separately copyrightable. However, it also includes works where the compiled materials are not separately copyrightable, such as a reference index to the Bible. D. A translation of a foreign work. ¿Qué pasa? E. A supplementary work, which is a work supplementing another work. Clever definitions, these copyright guys, eh? These are things like the introduction to a book. For a brief period in 1999, master recordings were added to the categories listed above. In other words, the Copyright Act said they could be works for hire. However, the artist community went ballistic, and after a battle royale, Congress reversed itself and took out masters. Nonetheless, record companies take the position that an album is a collective work, and therefore think they have the right to treat masters as works for hire anyway. We'll talk about this in more detail at the end of Chapter 21. Before we can discuss the consequences of something being a work for hire, you need a few more concepts. So, plug it into your memory bank, or make a note of the time code for this point in the audiobook, if your memory is like mine, and we'll come back to it. Duration of copyright. Remember that a copyright is a limited duration monopoly? The next logical question is, how long? History. Prior to 1978, the United States had this bizarre copyright concept that was adopted in 1909 and not changed for almost 70 years. I tell you about it because, one, it's still relevant for older copyrights, and two, I had to learn it, so why shouldn't you listen to it? The main thing to know about these old copyrights is that they used to last for a period of 28 years from publication of the work. I could spend an entire chapter on what publication means, but I'd like you to finish my book Awake, so I'll skip it. Basically, it means distributed to the public. These copyrights were then renewable for an additional 28 years, so the maximum copyright protection was 56 years. In 1976, Congress did a major 70,000-mile overhaul of the copyright laws. It was so extensive that the 1976 Copyright Act wasn't effective until January 1, 1978, because Congress wanted to give everyone a year to study it. This new law dumped the 28 plus 28 nonsense. Instead, it said that the duration of copyright for works created after January 1, 1978 was the life of the author plus 50 years, which was already how the lives of copyrights were measured in a lot of other countries. Congress also extended the old 56-year terms for works created before January 1, 1978 by 19 years, for a total of 75 years. In 1998, the congressional folk got together again to talk about copyright. In memory of Congressman and croonster Sonny Bono, they slapped on another 20 years, known as the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, or, as I like to think of it, I Got You 20, Babe. This act extended the copyright term for pre-1978 songs, if they were still under copyright, to a total of 95 years, and gave the 1978 and later copyrights a term equal to the life of the author plus 70 years. When a copyright expires, the work goes into the public domain, also called PD, which means anyone can use it for free. So new copyrights last for life of the author plus 70 years. Simple, right? Well, how about 1. A work written by 2 people. Whose life do you use to measure the copyright duration? 2. A work written under a phony name, called a pseudonymous work, or something created anonymously. How do you know whose life to check on? 3. Works for hire. Remember, the author is the employer, who could be a corporation, and some of those suckers live forever. Rest comfortably, dear friends, because all of these have been handled. They work like this. 1. In the case of a joint work, the copyright lasts until 70 years after the death of the last survivor. So write all your songs with your 5-year-old daughter. 2. Anonymous, no name, or pseudonymous, phony name works last the sooner of 95 years from publication, or 120 years from creation. Creation means the first time it's fixed in a tangible form, written down or recorded. Publication, as I said, is a tricky little devil, but for our purposes, just assume it means distribution to the public. 3. Works for hire are the same as anonymous. Right of termination. One of the best goodies that creators got in the 1976 copyright law is the right of termination. The termination provisions say that even if you make a bonehead deal, the copyright law will give you a second shot, 35 years later. In other words, 35 years after a transfer, you can get your copyright back. By the way, this termination is only for the U.S. copyright. You're stuck with whatever deal you made for the rest of the world. As it happens, the United States is the only country where you get a do-over. The exact mechanics get a bit technical, so I've stuck them at the beginning of Chapter 20 in a section for the diehards. Termination of works for hire. Not so fast, Charlie. Now you know enough to understand the consequences of something being a work for hire. Refer back to earlier in this chapter for what that is. With works for hire, there are no termination rights, because there was no transfer in the first place, and therefore, no transfer to terminate. Remember, the creator never existed in the eyes of the copyright law. The person or company commissioning the work owns it as if they had created it themselves. So with works for hire, there's no copyright coming back to you and your kiddies. Bummer. Be very aware of this consequence when you create a work for hire. Public performance of masters. In most developed countries outside the United States, the artist and record company are paid a royalty every time a recording is played on the radio. Note, we're talking here about record company and artist payments from the public performance of masters, which is very different from royalties that are paid to a songwriter and publisher for the public performance of musical compositions, which was always done in the United States. Even though artists and record companies have been paid for the performance of masters in other territories from the beginning, the United States didn't recognize this right until 1995. In fact, as we'll discuss later, when Congress created a sound recording copyright in 1972 to stop piracy, it went out of its way to say there was no public performance royalty. And when they finally did get around to a performance royalty in 1995, Congress limited it to digital performance of the masters. So unlike other countries, there's no performance money for use of the masters in over-the-air radio broadcasting, also called terrestrial radio. We'll discuss this in more detail soon. In foreign territories, the master performance monies can be really significant. That sounds like good news, except that U.S. artists aren't usually entitled to collect them. The reason is pretty simple. Since the United States doesn't pay foreign artists when their masters are performed in the U.S., foreign countries don't pay U.S. artists when their masters are performed over there. In part, this comes from a sense of fairness, and to keep a balance of monies going in and out of the territory. but it's also a way to make more money available to the local artists. If U.S. artists aren't taking money for the performance of masters, there's more left over for the locals. However, in some territories, the record companies collect these monies if the artist can't. In recent years, it's been possible for Americans to get paid for some countries, but only if you jump through the proper hoops. Those hoops vary from place to place, and a key player in this obstacle course is something called the Rome Convention, an international treaty dealing with intellectual property. If your country signed the Rome Convention, you get performance monies from all the other countries that signed it. Most of the countries that signed it are in Europe and Scandinavia, though Japan and Australia also came to the party. Guess which country didn't sign it? Right, the US of A. Still, you can get some foreign monies. Portugal, Romania, Hungary, Russia, and Spain pay everybody. Germany pays if the record is released in a Rome Convention country within 30 days of its initial release in a non-Rome Convention territory, which, because of streaming, means most every record these days. You can also get paid if you're signed to a label that's based in a Rome Convention country. Another way to be eligible for payment is to record, or partially record, your masters in a Rome Convention country. By the way, Canada is a party to the Rome Convention, and they have great recording studios. The place where you render your services is the key to whether you're entitled to foreign performance money. For example, if you record your vocals in Canada, you're golden. If all the musicians record in Canada, but you sing in Wyoming, you're toast, though Wyoming is lovely this time of year. Okay, let's take a look at what Congress did for us Americans. U.S. Digital Performance of Masters. In 1995, Congress amended Section 106 of the Copyright Act with something called the Digital Performance Right in Sound Recordings Act of 1995. Those folks in Washington sure know how to put a sexy title on something, huh? Section 106 says you get paid for performances of your master if all of the following apply. 1. It must be a digital public performance, meaning a digital transmission, rather than over-the-air AM and FM radio. In the last few years, many radio stations have converted their over-the-air signals to digital, HD radio, which is a digital signal. So it sounds like you'll get performance monies when they play your masters over the air, right? Well, turns out the broadcasters have a lot of friends in Congress. In a nice little lobbying move, they managed to exclude digital over-the-air broadcasts from the definition of digital performances. The only exception is when a radio station simulcasts its signal over the internet, meaning it streams the signal at the same time that it broadcasts over the air. In that case, you get paid for the streaming portion, but not the over-the-air part. With the world moving to streaming, however, this means more money coming your way. 2. You only get paid for the digital performance of audio-only sound recordings, meaning the artist doesn't get paid for performances of a master in films, TV shows, or commercials. So to break it down, the only digital performances that fall under Section 106 are audio-only digital transmissions that don't go over the air. This includes satellite radio services like Sirius XM, digital cable and satellite television audio music channels, e.g. Music Choice, non-interactive webcasters, both retransmissions of FCC-licensed radio stations on the internet and originally programmed internet-only services, services that stream to commercial businesses, grocery store music, streaming to mobile devices, and other assorted digital weirdos. If a broadcast qualifies for a performance royalty under this criteria, you get paid one of two ways. 1. In 1998, Congress followed up their 1995 extravaganza with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, also known as the DMCA. This baby set up a compulsory license for non-interactive streaming of masters. That means, under certain conditions, which we'll discuss in a second, the owner of a sound recording must allow a user to transmit it. If the broadcast qualifies for the compulsory license, you get the fees laid out by the Copyright Royalty Board, which I'll give you in a second. If the use doesn't qualify for the compulsory license, 2. Remember, as we discussed in Chapter 15, that a copyright owner can stop someone from using their work without permission unless they get a compulsory license. Because the DMCA compulsory license we just discussed is limited to non-interactive uses, an interactive digital service provider, DSP, such as Spotify, Apple Music, and Amazon, has to get a voluntary license from the owner of the sound recording. Otherwise, they're out of business. That's the big picture. Now let's take a look at the compulsory and voluntary licenses in more depth. Non-interactive compulsory licenses. How does a broadcaster qualify for a compulsory license? The rules are found in the riveting Section 114 of the Copyright Act, where there's a whole slug of requirements that boil down to making you act like a non-interactive radio station. For example, you can't announce your playlist in advance. There are limits on how many songs of a particular artist you can play in any 3-hour period. There is a limit on the number of songs from a particular album in a 3-hour period, and stuff like that. If a broadcaster qualifies for a compulsory license, it pays statutory license fees, meaning rates set by the statute, to an outfit called Sound Exchange. Sound Exchange is a nonprofit organization whose board is made up of record company people, artists, and artist representatives. Essentially, it acts like ASCAP and BMI, meaning it collects fees from all the users, deducts its costs, and pays the balance to its members. Except, of course, that it's dealing with the performances of masters instead of songs. Sound Exchange collects substantial monies. In 2018, it collected over $950 million, a double-digit increase over 2017, and it expects to go over $1 billion in 2019. Sound Exchange divvies up the dough as follows: 50% to the record companies, 45% to the featured artists, and 5% to a fund controlled by the American Federation of Musicians for non-featured musicians, and AFTRA for non-featured vocalists. See the top of Chapter 6 for who AFM and AFTRA are. The artist monies go to you directly, not through your label, so they can't be used to recoup any advances or costs. Thank your representatives in Congress. The rates are incredibly complex. They vary with whether you're a commercial webcaster, an FCC-licensed station or other webcaster that puts its signal on the net, an educational webcaster, like a college radio station, or a non-commercial webcaster, a charity, NPR, and the like. Also within the commercial category, there's a distinction between subscription-based webcasters and ad-supported, free-to-the-user webcasters. Got all that? Good, because there's more. At the higher end, there are SDARs, which sounds like a lung disease epidemic, but in fact means Satellite Digital Audio Radio Services. The only one is Sirius XM. BES, meaning Business Establishment Services, who pump music into restaurants, hotels, and tropical fish stores. CABSAT, standing for Cable/Satellite Services, who deliver music over cable or satellite to your TV or set-top box. And PES, which means Pre-Existing Subscription Services, that were in existence prior to July 31, 1998, like Sirius XM and Music Choice. Because the older subscription services have been around a while, and because they have strong lobbyists and lawyers, they get a senior citizen discount and pay about half of what others pay for the same service. Because this includes the massive Sirius XM, the record companies aren't exactly thrilled. The rates are fractions of pennies for each performance, and if you really want to know the details, though I can't imagine why, head over to SoundExchange's website, www.soundexchange.com. Click on Service Provider, then click on the tab to the left that says Rates. I'm sure the exact clicks get changed now and then, but I'm guessing you can figure that out. When you've had your fill, be sure to like them on their Facebook page. Other than National Public Radio, there's a minimum per year for each service of $500 per channel or station, with a cap ranging from $50,000 per year to as high as $100,000 per year for the CABSAT/SDARS/PES folks. BES folks have a minimum of $20,000 per year. These minimums are advances against the per-performance fee. Voluntary licenses. If a performance doesn't fall within the statutory license, primarily this means performances on interactive services, then as we noted, the record company charges whatever the traffic will bear. In other words, this is a voluntary license between the record company, the owner of the master, and the DSPs. Note, unlike the compulsory license, all the money goes to the record company. That means artists are paid through their record deals, and the money is available for recoupment. Under these voluntary license deals, the DSPs pay a percentage of their revenue to the labels, as we discussed in Chapter 12. To interact or not to interact. There are some legally interesting in-between types of services that are arguably interactive and arguably non-interactive. For example, Pandora lets you tell them what kind of music you like, then they customize a stream for you. You can also tell them whether or not you like each song, and the more feedback you give them, the better they get at pleasing you with their choices, at least in theory. So you sort of control the content, but not exactly. You can't tell them to play a specific song at a specific time, but you can shape what's coming at you. The record companies argued that this made these services interactive, and therefore they had to get a voluntary license, which is much more expensive than a non-interactive license. The services had a very different opinion, saying they were non-interactive and therefore entitled to a compulsory license. This led the major record companies to sue a company called Launchcast, which had a service similar to Pandora's, for copyright infringement. All the record companies settled this case except Sony, who took it to trial in New York. The trial court ruled in favor of Launchcast, saying their service wasn't interactive, and Launchcast won the appeal as well. So for now, these services are non-interactive. However, some of the DSPs offer a mid-tier service, priced in between non-interactive and interactive, which has more interactivity, such as the ability to repeat songs, hear some material offline, maybe see the songs in advance, etc. They can't get a compulsory license when they offer these features, so they have to go to the record labels and get a voluntary license. These deals look just like the interactive services deals, meaning they pay the labels a percentage of their revenue in the mid-50% range. This percentage, however, is applied to the lower fee charged for the mid-tier services, as opposed to the full interactive subscription fee for customers that get the fully interactive service. Video streaming. There's no compulsory license for video streaming, whether it's interactive or not. So the companies charge whatever they can get. We covered the rates that publishers and master owners get earlier in Chapter 16 and Chapter 12. But these deals are worse than the deals for audio streaming. Really? Yeah, really. Why? It's not a pretty picture. The DMCA and its not-so-safe harbor. The most important issue in video streaming is the safe harbor rule of the DMCA. Refer back to earlier in this chapter for what the DMCA is. To understand what this is about, think back to the list of rights you get when you own a copyright. One of these is the right to distribute your work. In other words, if someone creates an infringing work and someone else distributes it to the public, you can go after both of them. One sleazo infringed the duplication right, while the other one infringed the distribution right. Under the DMCA, Section 512 of the Copyright Act, there is an exception to this distribution liability. Specifically, a digital service provider isn't liable for distribution of infringing material if it didn't create it, post it, or know it was infringing. In other words, if one of the users puts up an infringing video, the DSP can't be sued for copyright infringement. You can only sue the dork who put up the video. The reasoning is that so much content goes through the DSP's pipes that they can't be responsible for every bozo who posts something. However, if the copyright owner gives the DSP a notice that says it's distributing infringing material, the DSP has to take it down. If it keeps distributing after the notice, then the owner can sue them for copyright infringement. That all sounded reasonable enough when it came into being. But then YouTube showed up. Suddenly, hundreds of millions of videos were being uploaded, and a lot of those infringed somebody's rights. For example, fans routinely put up an entire album, including the cover artwork. So a record company or publisher sends them a notice that says, "Knock it off," and they stop. Easy, right? Well, what actually happens is what we in the industry call whack-a-mole, named after the arcade game where a mole pops up, you bop it on the head with a mallet, and another mole pops up nearby. In other words, as soon as YouTube takes down a particular post, hundreds of identical others appear. So the copyright owners send out hundreds more notices. YouTube takes those down, and thousands more appear. Out go thousands of notices. Rinse and repeat. Meaning, no matter how many notices you send, the lemmings keep coming. Viacom sued YouTube over this, claiming that videos on YouTube were using a massive amount of Viacom television content, which they were. Viacom's claim was that, A, YouTube was chock-full of infringing material. It was and still is. B, YouTube knew it was infringing. And C, YouTube could stop it if they wanted to. YouTube basically said, under the law, we don't have to stop it, and we don't want to. After some legal wrangling, the courts agreed with YouTube. But the appeals and fighting continued hot and heavy. Finally, the case was settled. There's a reported appellate decision, Viacom International v. YouTube, number 10-3270, 2012, WL113085, 2nd Circuit, April 5, 2012, for you technical freaks. But there was a lot of action before and after that decision in the lower courts. If you're interested, Google Viacom versus YouTube, and you can get a lot of information. There's some irony in that, since Google owns YouTube. Anyway, to date, no one has found a way to stop this practice, so the industry decided to just give a license to YouTube, on the theory that it's better to get something rather than nothing, which is what they were getting from sending takedown notices. The music biz is not happy. YouTube streams more music than all the other sites put together, offers a fully interactive service on mobile, where most of the music consumption happens these days, and because they're advertiser-based, they pay way less money than the subscription services, as we discussed in Chapter 12. If the labels and publishers had the legal right to stop YouTube, they could stop or limit its ability to give away what these subscription services are charging for. But since they can't stop them, so far, they don't have that much leverage in their negotiations. YouTube did start a paid subscription service and made essentially the same deal that the subscription DSPs made. But at least as of this writing, it's dwarfed by the other services, and seriously dwarfed by the free YouTube music streams. A late-breaking, at the time I'm writing this, development is that the European Parliament voted to do away with the safe harbor in Europe. That's really big. If YouTube can't stream in Europe without making a deal, they'll be forced to give better terms worldwide. The Parliament's vote is, in essence, an instruction to members of the European Union, telling them to get rid of the safe harbor in their country. However, the various countries aren't required to do this for 2 years, and meanwhile the tech folks are lobbying their silicon off in an effort to stop it. What happens when someone rips off your copyright? When someone uses a part of your song without permission, they infringe your copyright. And there have been a lot of high-profile copyright infringement cases in the music area over the last few years, the most notable being the Stairway to Heaven case, Skidmore v. Led Zeppelin, Volume 905, Federal Reporter, 3rd Series, page 1116, 9th Circuit, 2018, and the Blurred Lines decision, Williams v. Gay, Volume 895, Federal Reporter, 3rd Series, page 1106, 9th Circuit, 2018. The Blurred Lines case is finished. The Gay estate won, and Zeppelin is still ongoing at the time of this writing. Basically, as with every other copyright infringement lawsuit, they turned on the same issue. Did you steal my song? If you think someone ripped off your song, you can sue them for it. But there are quite a few hurdles you have to jump before you can back a truck up to their house and fill it with money, lamps, and rugs. Here's the story. 1. First, before you file suit, you have to either A. be the copyright owner, or B. have an exclusive license of the rights that are being infringed, or C. be what's called a beneficial owner, which means you sold someone your copyright in exchange for royalties, or D. be a nutcase, but have $400 and know where the courthouse is. Unfortunately, my clients have seen a number of these. 2. Assuming you're one of those, you then have to register the copyright with the Copyright Office. More about that in Chapter 20, before you can file the suit. Registration is also important because you can only sue for things that happened within the 3 years before you filed your lawsuit. So the later you register, the longer you have to wait before you can sue. To be more specific, you can only file suit for copyright damages within 3 years after the infringement. So if they stopped using the infringing materials more than 3 years ago, you can't sue them. If the infringement is continuing, for example, they're still streaming records with your song, you can file suit more than 3 years after the first infringement. But you only can recover damages based on monies earned in the 3 years before filing. Some courts have held that the 3 years don't start until you either knew or should have known about the infringement, a concept called delayed discovery. In other words, if you never knew about the infringement or couldn't reasonably have known about it, you can get damages all the way back to the first infringement, even if it was 20 years earlier. However, there's a cloud over this sunshine. The Supreme Court seemed to say, but not 100% clearly, that 3 years from the first infringement was absolute, even if you didn't and couldn't have known about it. The case is Petrella v. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, Inc., Volume 134, Supreme Court Reporter, page 1962, 2014. Because this opinion wasn't 100% clear, however, some lower courts still use the delayed discovery rule. To date, it hasn't been decided by an appellate court, so feel free to give it a whirl. There is also a recent case concerning registration that affects all this, but I've stuck it back in Chapter 20 because it's a bit more technical. 3. Okay, you've registered and filed. What do you have to do to win? 4. The first thing you have to prove is that the thief actually copied your work. Since most infringers don't say, "Yeah, I copied your song," though some do, as you'll see, you have to prove they did. Maybe someone saw them copying your song, or maybe they recorded their writing sessions and those recordings show that they were thinking of your song at the time. This, of course, almost never happens. Usually you have to prove they copied you by showing the court that your work and theirs have a striking similarity. Striking similarity is a legal term that means the two songs are so much alike that it can only be explained by copying. And of course, this also rarely happens, though it can. Most thieves are smart enough to change the work a bit. Now what? Even if there's no striking similarity between your song and theirs, you're not dead yet. You can still win if you prove that A, there is substantial similarity. This is a lower standard than striking similarity between your work and theirs, and B, the infringer had access to your work. There's no bright line for what substantial similarity means, and because each case is unique, there's not much guidance. The courts say it means more than insubstantial, duh, and more than insignificant. If what was taken was really minimal, but of course attorneys have to use fancier words than that, so it's called de minimis, there's no infringement. If it was substantially similar and not de minimis, it's an infringement. Access is a legal term that means they had a way to hear your song and rip it off. For example, someone gave your song to an artist, hoping they'd record it, and the artist later wrote a song that was substantially similar to yours. In the early days of the Internet, some courts assumed there was access if your song was posted on the web, even if you only had 12 hits. But that's been cut way back. With billions of postings on YouTube, the access test now requires that your song be very widely known. For example, in the top 50 on a credible record chart, or that it was in a genre that the thief listened to a lot, or in a section of the Internet where the thief went repeatedly. Things like that. By the way, you don't need to prove there was access if you can show striking similarity, the test we first discussed, between your song and theirs. That's because of a concept called presumed access, which means a court will presume the thief had access to your song if the two works are strikingly similar. However, if they're only substantially similar, you need to show access. But wait, there's more. 5. Okay, you've shown access and substantial similarity. Do you win? Maybe. Even if there's substantial similarity and access, there's no infringement if the infringer can prove they independently created their song. In other words, if someone writes a substantially similar song all on their own, without hearing your song, there's no copyright infringement, no matter how close the two songs are. A particularly interesting case in this area involved George Harrison, who was found guilty of copying the song "He's So Fine" in his song "My Sweet Lord." George claimed he created "My Sweet Lord" without even thinking about "He's So Fine." And what's unusual about this case is that the court actually believed him. But he still lost. This case created a principle we call unconscious copying. This means he copied without being aware of it, because the song was very well known and somewhere buried in his brain. For the legal folks, the citation is Bright Tunes Music Corp. v. Harrisongs Music Limited, Volume 420, Federal Supplement, Page 177, 1976. 6. Okay, you proved that this scumbag had access and didn't create his work on his own. Now you're a ways down the track. How far? The next test is whether or not the material he copied is protected by copyright. In other words, you have to prove what he copied from your song was original to you. This means two things. 1. You created the material yourself, rather than copying it from someone else. And 2. What you wrote has some degree of creativity. For example, regarding 1. If you borrowed your melody from Mozart note for note, you didn't create anything, and the thief is free to use that melody. Or regarding 2. If your lyrics were, "I love you with all my heart, you mean everything to me," they'd not only be boring, but also so commonplace that they don't have enough creativity to be copyrightable. For the legal freaks, the primary case in this area is Feist Publications, Inc., v. Rural Telephone Service Company, Volume 499, U.S. Reports, pages 340 and 345, Volume 111, Supreme Court, pages 1282 and 1287, Volume 113, Lawyers, Second Edition, page 358, 1991. A significant case about originality is the Rentmeester case, where a photographer took the original picture of Michael Jordan in his famous Jumpman pose. That's the one where he's leaping in the air with his legs split and his arm extended, holding a basketball. I'd be happy to add it to the PDF, but I don't want to get sued for copyright infringement. Google it. Nike liked what he did and licensed copies of the photo from Rentmeester for very limited use. Then they decided they wanted to use the image in a major way. But instead of paying the photographer for more rights to use the picture, they decided to stage their own photo of Michael Jordan in the same pose. Mr. Rentmeester was not pleased, so he sued Nike, claiming they'd infringed the copyright in his photo by duplicating the pose. And Mr. Rentmeester was even less pleased when the court tossed out his case, saying that he couldn't claim copyright infringement. I don't know anything about ballet, but apparently Jordan's pose was inspired by a dance move known as a grand jeté. Sounds more like a jacuzzi part to me, but hey. At any rate, grand jetés existed long before Rentmeester did. Also, the Nike photo was in a different location, meaning it had a different background and a different hoop. So even though Nike admitted copying the concept, the court, the law court, not a basketball court, decided there was no infringement because none of Rentmeester's original elements were used. This case also illustrates the principle that you can't copyright an idea, just the expression of that idea. So the score is Nike 1, Rentmeester 0. If you want to relive his sorrow, the case is Rentmeester v. Nike, Inc., Volume 883, Federal Reporter, 3rd Series, page 1111, 2018. The fact that the dance move pre-existed the Rentmeester photo leads us nicely into another aspect of copyright infringement known as prior art. That means, as the name implies, that you can't claim you created something that existed before you created your work. This is an especially important element in music cases, as there are only 12 notes in a scale, and they've been used a lot. In other words, if the thief copied a phrase in your song that's the same as a phrase used in 40 songs that existed way before yours, prior art, you can't claim enough originality to sustain an infringement suit. Another aspect of this issue is whether the infringed materials were just following a well-worn path of prior art. In other words, if the infringed material has to naturally flow from the genre or idea of the material, it's not protectable. For example, in the film area, if you make a space movie, it's not protectable just to have spaceships, aliens, ray gun battles, and things like that. And in music, there are standard blues chord progressions that you pretty much have to use, if you want to write the blues anyway. Or if your song is a waltz, it has to be in 3/4 time. 7. So let's say you're through those hoops. You've shown that the material they stole from you is original and protected. What's next? Wheel out the operating table, because the court will now dissect your work. If your song has some original elements and some that aren't original, they're going to toss out everything that isn't original. That's because you can only sue over stuff that's protected by copyright, meaning original material created by you. For example, if you wrote new lyrics to the tune of Old MacDonald, you couldn't sue over the melody, just over your new lyrics. If you wrote something using the standard blues progression, you can't sue over that chord structure, just your words and melody. This dissecting is done very clinically. Experts make up charts of both songs, play recordings of your song and compare them to recordings of the other song, and then argue about what it all means. When they're done yelling, the court decides which parts are protected and which aren't. They then compare your protected parts against the thief's work to see if there is substantial similarity between the two, the test I mentioned earlier. If there is, we're on to the next hurdle. If not, you're off the track. 8. Well, you've shown that they copied protected material from you, and that their work is substantially similar to your protected work, and it's not de minimis. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? No, honey, but I'll let you know when we are, and I'll buy you an ice cream. The tests just mentioned are all reasonably cut and dried. The way that the experts lay out the songs on a table and look at the words, notes, chord progressions, prior art, etc., is an objective test, based on the bones of the two works. Sort of like taking two pieces of paper with similar writing, putting one on top of the other, and holding them up to the light to see how much alike they are. Once you get past that, you arrive at the next test, which is a subjective one. In essence, that means, does it sound like an infringement? Even if it looks very close on the objective scale, would someone listening to it think it came from your work? If the answer is yes, do you win? Probably, but... 9. Even if the works sound alike, and you prove they stole a protectable part of your work, the infringer may argue that his use was something called fair use, and if that's true, you lose. Fair use is a complicated and pretty interesting area of the law that says you're allowed to use protectable parts of someone's work for certain purposes without permission and without paying them. In other words, if you meet the legal tests so that you've made a fair use of the work, there's no copyright infringement. The fair use criteria are in Section 107 of the Copyright Act, but they're only a general description, as you'll see. The reality is that every fair use case is very fact-specific, which of course makes lawyers happy, because we get to argue about which foot will fit into the Cinderella slipper. So here's what the Copyright Act says. A fair use is not a copyright infringement if it's for purposes such as criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, including multiple copies for classroom use, scholarship, or research. It then lists things you should consider in deciding whether you went over the line into infringement territory. However, it says the factors determining fair use include the things on their list, which means you can look at other stuff as well. See what I mean about it being a general description? Anyway, here is the list in Section 107. To determine if there's a fair use, you need to look at 1. The purpose and character of the use, including whether it's a commercial use or nonprofit educational purposes. It's okay if there's some commercial aspect involved, but the more there is, the stricter the test. 2. The nature of the copyrighted work, the one that's been copied. The courts have distinguished between creative works, songs, novels, paintings, etc., and factual works, such as nonfiction books and directories. Creative works have more protection, as you'd expect. 3. The amount and substantiality of the portion used in relation to the copyrighted work as a whole. The general principle is that the more that's used, the less likely it's fair use. However, there's an argument that using even a small portion that is the heart of a work could go over the line. 4. The effect of the use upon the potential market for or value of the copyrighted work. The question here is whether the new work would be a substitute for the original in the marketplace, and therefore financially hurt the original. For example, a Saturday Night Live parody sketch of a movie isn't going to hurt the market for the movie. In fact, it most likely helps. But a parody song that uses most of the elements of the original song might in fact be a substitute for the original. As I said, fair use is always going to be very fact-specific, meaning it's hard to know with certainty whether you've got one. An easy example would be a professor at a nonprofit college who copies a few paragraphs from a book into a classroom handout, clearly a fair use, versus someone who copies an entire book and sells it to the students, clearly not. In between, things get hazy. A major issue that's come out of the courts in determining fair use is whether the use is transformative. This concept started with a music case that went all the way to the Supreme Court, over two live crew using the lyrics of Pretty Woman in a rap song. The background is that they tried to license the song, got turned down, then went ahead anyway. So the owners of the song sued them for infringement. To the industry's surprise, the Supreme Court held there was no infringement because the new use parodied the original song by satirizing the idea of what was pretty and used the song in an entirely different setting. The case is Campbell v. Acuff Rose Music, Volume 510, United States Reporter, page 569, 1994. Since then, there have been a number of cases on transformation, including some fun things like superimposing Leslie Nielsen's head on the pregnant body of Demi Moore. That was held to be transformative and a fair use. If you want to see an assortment of goodies to better understand the concept, Google transformative use copyright cases. To make this even more fun, the courts in various parts of the country have a difference of opinion. Two of the circuit courts held that using copyrighted material to create another work is transformative and fair use. But one circuit said it's an infringement because it's just another derivative work. Refer back to Chapter 15 for what derivative work means. Unless and until the Supreme Court weighs in, we'll continue to live in fuzzy land. Okay, honey, we're there. What flavor ice cream do you want? I won. Now what? If you prove someone infringed your copyright, what do you get? Some of this is peculiar to the copyright and also trademark world. Here's how it works. 1. You get the fair market value of the use they made. For example, if they rip off your song in a commercial, and that use of the song is worth $25,000 in a marketplace deal, you can get $25,000. 2. You can recover the infringer's profits. If the sleazeball made a profit using your work, you can recover his profits, which may be more than the fair market value of the usage. If you pick this remedy, you don't also get fair market value. 3. You can get an injunction. This means the court enjoins, stops the infringer from using, the infringing work. If they continue to use it anyway, they're subject to substantial fines, and sometimes even jail. 4. You can recover statutory damages. Statutory damages are a real copyright original. This is where you can't prove actual damages. For example, your infringer was not only a thief, but also a bungling businessman, and he lost money with your ripoff. Or maybe his profits are so well hidden that you can't find them. In this case, if you registered the copyright before the infringement commenced, the court can give you anywhere from $750 to $30,000 for a single infringement. This is per act of infringement, not the number of copies actually made. For example, putting out 100,000 CDs with your song is still only one act of infringement. The judge can raise this to $150,000 if it's a willful, intentional infringement, and can lower it to $200 for an innocent infringement. 5. The court can order destruction or seizure. The court can grab, or make the scumball destroy, all the infringing copies. This is also not a common remedy outside the copyright area. 6. If the infringement is willful, there are criminal penalties. An interesting bit of history is that the Marx Brothers stole some poor schlub's copyright for a radio show and were convicted of criminal copyright infringement. 7. You can get your costs. You can get back your court costs and, to a limited extent, you can recover your attorney's fees. The latter is unusual because you usually don't get attorney's fees even if you win a lawsuit. If you're on the advanced overview track and are in a group, go to Part 4, Chapter 21. If you're on the advanced overview track and you're not in a group, go to Part 5, Chapter 22. Experts, keep rolling. Chapter 20. Even more advanced copyright concepts. Sound recording copyrights. It may surprise you to know that prior to 1972, the United States had no copyright protection for a sound recording itself. I'm now talking about the physical, master sound recording, not the musical composition. And pirates were making a lot of money by duplicating sound recordings and not paying anyone. This smelled like thievery, which it was, but there was no federal copyright in the sound recording to stop them from duplicating. The companies did pretty well by suing pirates under the copyright laws of individual states. There was no federal law, so they had to go to the states, and these state laws have interestingly become important in the last few years. More about that in a minute. In 1972, Congress enacted a full-fledged, legitimate copyright law provision dealing with piracy, which is now Section 114 of the Copyright Act. It prohibits the unauthorized duplication or dubbing of a sound recording that was created on or after February 15, 1972, by creating a copyright in the actual recording. This is in addition to a separate copyright in the musical composition. It is imaginatively called a sound recording copyright. One of the most interesting aspects of this sound recording copyright is what it did not protect. While it's clear you can no longer duplicate records without consent, the sound recording copyright doesn't prohibit a sound-alike recording, no matter how closely you duplicate the original. In other words, nothing in the sound recording copyright stops you from hiring a singer to imitate the original artist, or hiring a band that sounds just like the original recording, regardless of how close you come. Of course, you still need to license the song, and you have to disclose that the recording isn't the original. If you didn't label your record as an imitation, you'd run afoul of various trademark and unfair practice laws, which deal with the proper labeling of goods, and thus stop you from defrauding the public into thinking they're getting the original when they're not. These are the same laws that stop you from calling a cereal Grape Nuts if it's not made by Post, even if it has exactly the same ingredients. Not so happy together. So the sound recording copyright is good for masters created after February 15, 1972. But there's no federal sound recording copyright for pre-72 masters. Recently, that little quirk came back to life like some monster in an old horror movie. And the villains this time? The digital streaming services, our old friends, the DSPs. Remember, as we discussed back in Chapter 12, the DSPs pay out each month on the basis of how many plays they get compared to the total number of plays on their service. Well, these oldies had a fair amount of play, so they should have gotten some of the money. But the DSPs said they didn't have to pay for them because there was no sound recording copyright. Accordingly, they allocated a share of their revenue to the old masters based on their number of plays, carved that chunk out of what they paid everyone else, and stuck it in their pockets. As you can imagine, the recordings of the Beatles and a lot of other classic artists get a hell of a lot of play on these services, so they were not pleased. This led to a number of lawsuits over this issue, essentially using the state law claims that were used to shut down pirates before the sound recording copyright existed. The biggest case was headed by the RIAA, an industry group that represents the major labels, and there was also a class action led by the Turtles. Class action means that a lawsuit on behalf of everyone similarly situated, which in this case meant everyone who owned pre-1972